After a few weeks, I'm getting restless in Paris. Although Stephanie is working on a recording career, there is a profound lack of work ethic in her circle. And while I can party and drink with the best of them, even I need a day off from time to time. Not so in Paris. So I begin waking up before Stephanie and working out with Glenn, who is a champion martial artist.
Rob, if they want to rip my heart out, I will still walk. If they want to tear me open, I would keep coming. If they pull my insides out, I will still be crawling,
Glenn says one day, apropos of nothing. Is that what they teach you in martial arts, I ask?
No, it is just who I am.
Okay, I say, not sure of his point. Good to know. With consecutive hit films behind me, I'm getting antsy to go back home and take care of business. This idle life of leisure is proving much more taxing than I would have thought. My agents are putting together my next movie, and with my new profile as a romantic leading man, it has a lot riding on it. I tell Stephanie, who understands. She will come to L.A. in the next few weeks for a meeting on a record deal. I begin to pack my things. I come across a magazine under a stack in Stephanie's closet. It's French, from 6 months ago, and I'm on the cover. Look what I found, I say to her, and she blushes.
I put it away when I finally met you. I kept it on my nightstand for months, she says.
Glenn drives me to the airport. I've had to leave on even shorter notice to take a meeting, and all the flights are full. But Glenn, however, always keeps two seats reserved on every Concorde flight out of Paris. I use one to go home. But now the auto route is in total gridlock, and there's no way I'll make the flight. Glenn wheels the car onto the side of the road, hits the blue siren, and drives the entire way on the shoulder of the freeway. Every once in a while, we clip a car's side-view mirror, and it shatters with a bang. Glenn is unfazed. As we pull up to De Gaulle, I'm overwhelmed by a sense of finality. A very romantic, chaotic, exotic, bomb-filled month or so is coming to an end. In a life of extraordinary moments, even I know this one was remarkable. Goodbye, Glenn. I can't thank you enough for all your help, for taking such good care of me, for the fun and the friendship.
And for Stephanie?
He smiles. Glenn, I've been around you almost every day for weeks, and I've never heard you even attempt a joke until now.
I am learning from you. I want to have more fun in my life, and I admire your ability to do that,
he says, looking almost wistful. Well, I admire you too, even if I don't know what the fuck you're really up to. He smiles and looks down. I head for the gorgeous needle-nose jet glinting in the morning sun. I have my lunch meeting at the Russian Tea Room in Manhattan, fly home, and eat dinner alone at McDonald's in Malibu. I am transitioning back to reality. Back in Paris, Glenn goes to the gym after dropping me off at the airport and then heads home. Getting out of the Mercedes in front of his house, he is shot multiple times in the chest by three masked gunmen. He collapses on the hood of the car. Hearing the shots, his girlfriend comes out of the house calling his name. When he hears her voice, Glenn forces himself to rise and buttons up his jacket, sparing her the sight of his wounds, which he knows are grave.
I have been shot. I need to go to the hospital. We won't be able to wait for an ambulance.
He gives directions as she drives. He crosses his legs to hide the blood pooling in his seat. He is white and consciousness is fading. The ride takes 15 minutes.
I think the back entry will be quicker at this hour, he calculates.
Somehow he walks unaided into the ER. The staff take one look at him and rush to help him.
I have five wounds. I believe they are 9mm, he tells them before passing out.
Glenn dies on the operating table. His girlfriend tells me the story in a matter-of-fact delivery. She's obviously in deep shock. I am sitting among my baggage at my house. The phone was ringing as I walked in the door from McDonald's. I try to offer her any comfort I can, but I, too, am devastated. I may not know who Glenn worked for or who had him murdered, but I do know that it was likely a pro and from the highest levels, which means that it was well-planned, which means that they waited for the right moment, which means they waited for the moment that I was gone. I was later told that Glenn was honored by both the French and American governments for heroic service. President Reagan had a small ceremony at the White House and wrote a lovely letter of condolence to Glenn's father. Neither of these ceremonies, nor the assassination itself, was covered in the press in much detail. Glenn Suham's killing remains unsolved. Fans breaking into my house to steal underwear. Princesses. Professional hits in broad daylight. My life is becoming unreal, even to me. And, in spite of a very small inner voice warning me that this kind of chaos is not a good thing, I don't know how to stop it. Long, eventful careers, by definition, have cycles. Cycles are almost impossible to identify until you are well into their sequence. In retrospect, Glenn's death would be the first movement of a cycle in which I would be put at the wrong place at the wrong time and with people whose agendas conflicted with mine. Or, to put it simply, now would begin a period where I couldn't catch a break. Sometimes it would be completely my fault. Sometimes it wouldn't. My relationship with Stephanie is the first casualty of this undercurrent of conflict. While our life in Paris was a magical escape from reality, life in America is unrelenting reality. My mother, now deep into her illness, has a psychotic break after going off the drug Halcyon cold turkey. Steve, who has been prescribing medication for her, wants her committed. She wants him investigated for over-medication and attempted poisoning, and this all as I bring the princess home to meet them. As Stephanie sits in the living room, my mom has me cornered in the bedroom, forcing me to examine various used wads of Kleenex she believes have been shaped by Steve into voodoo dolls in an attempt to intimidate her into silence about his poisoning. I should have sent the princess packing, called my family into a room, and gotten to the bottom of all this insanity. Shamefully, I did not. My conflict, stress, reality avoidance mechanism, engaged so long ago in that hot Dayton lumberyard, had now grown into a monster. Stephanie and I flee back to a safe house, where we are both encamped, trailed by rabid paparazzi. There is a large bounty for the first photo of us together, but so far we've managed to stay under wraps. Finally, it's time for us to fly to Dallas, Texas, for our co-hosting duties. The Princess Grace Foundation raises money to support young, fledgling artists wherever they may be. The annual ball is always long on both Hollywood and actual royalty. Tonight's black tie event is packed. Frank Sinatra will perform. In the VIP area, I lock eyes with the chairman of the board. Never known as a people person, old Blue Eyes is under siege at the moment. Kitty Kelly's eviscerating bio has just come out. As Sinatra makes a beeline for me, I'm anxious. He marches right up, inches from my face, which he grabs with both hands. He leans in close, looking intensely into my eyes. Then he slaps me upside the head, hard. "My grandkids love ya," he says, and walks off. Stephanie, in the month I was in Paris, never introduced me to her father, Prince Rainier. I thought it was odd that she wouldn't want him to meet her new boyfriend. Now I'm hosting an event for his charity. He's standing 10 feet away from me, and I still haven't been introduced. He's glancing at me from time to time, but it's clear he has no intention of saying hello, much less thanking me, for 2 days of press and fundraising I'm doing on his behalf. My American anti-caste system inclinations begin to stir. I look over at him. He turns away. Finally, I walk over and offer my hand. The prince is doing that thing that one does of concentrating really hard on a bullshit story someone's telling, hoping to avoid any interlopers. No luck this time. "Excuse me, sir," I say, as his group stares open-mouthed. "I'm Rob Lowe. I'm hosting this event and dating your daughter. Welcome to the United States." Later in the evening, I find my old friend, Cary Grant. "Young man," he calls. "Congratulations to you on all of your success. I am so proud of you." It's a nice full circle from his early kind words so many years ago. We talk for a while, and then he moves on. Within months, he will be gone, the greatest movie star who ever lived. I know his amazing body of work well by now and take solace that I'll have more to remember him by than just soap on a rope. Stephanie and I are now over the buzz of our initial meeting, and it's clear that the mutual infatuation has been sated. We both know it's time to move on. Near the end of the evening, I look to the head table. It's late, and the men have congregated together, as have the women, who are off somewhere else. I see Gregory Peck, Robert Wagner, Cary Grant, and Prince Rainier, and approach the group. "Excuse me. I just wanted to say goodbye and thank you for letting me be a part of such a wonderful evening." Rainier grunts and nods. The rest offer warm goodbyes, and I head out. Then, when I am almost out of earshot, I hear from my future Austin Powers co-star Robert Wagner, "You know, guys, I think that kid's banged every one of our daughters." Peter Bogdanovich made The Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, and What's Up, Doc consecutively in the early 70s in what was probably the greatest back-to-back-to-back achievement of any director. Each movie is a classic, and for my money, two of them are perfect, The Last Picture Show and Paper Moon. And now, after an extended banishment, he is back in Hollywood's good graces due to his newest hit, Mask, for which Cher was nominated for an Oscar. I screen-tested for Mask and lost the part to Eric Stoltz. Bogdanovich had me put a stocking over my face with eye holes cut out to simulate the mask that the actor would wear. But he told me, your eyes are too identifiable, too unique. And that was that. But now he's directing a romantic comedy, and I've chosen it as my follow-up to About Last Night. I loved what Bogdanovich did with Ryan O'Neill, and I'm hoping he still has the mojo to do the same with me. And looking at Mask, it seems like a good bet. But from day one, my instincts scream at me that there are serious problems. For the slightly older female lead, names like Michelle Pfeiffer, Jodie Foster, and Melanie Griffith are discussed. But Peter is adamant that he be allowed to cast Colleen Camp, a good friend of his, and with whom he's worked before. I like Colleen, but I know that this type of movie needs star power. Still, I defer to my director, who, after all, has made some of the best movies in the genre. Peter also wants to rewrite the script from page one. The script was good enough to get us all to want to do it in the first place, so I'm worried about changing it. Even when Bogdanovich adds a major new character for his girlfriend to play, in spite of her never having acted before, and creates another role for his estate manager, I say nothing. Maybe these changes will elevate the movie to What's Up, Doc? But inside, I suspect otherwise. Rather than blow the movie apart, which confronting Bogdanovich most certainly would have done, I drink almost every day after work to quiet my conscience. Any one of these conceptual changes alone should have been sufficient grounds to depart immediately over creative differences. But I have no leadership in my life. My agents also represented Bogdanovich, and they weren't going to rock the boat. And I was an inveterate people pleaser who had very few personal boundaries. Plus, I loved Peter. He is one of the most well-read men I have ever met and among the most charismatic. He could lead you anywhere and you would follow, happy to be in his entertaining, insightful company. But every artist can chase their own vision into a blind alley, and on Illegally Yours, he did just that. After seeing the final cut, the studio let it sit in the can as unreleasable. Eventually, it came out in a few cities to scathing reviews. The original writers took their name off of it. But stars have no such luxury, no way to avoid the fallout, and that is one of the reasons why they get, and deserve, the big bucks. My agents and I were smart enough to go directly to another movie to minimize the damage to my leading man momentum. And this time, the movie would turn out pretty well. Masquerade is a sexual thriller out of the Patricia Highsmith mold. Morally ambivalent in tone, it is a dark, sexy, and sophisticated movie that gives me my first antihero role. Meg Tilly is terrific as the vulnerable heiress whom I seduce, and Kim Cattrall is perfect as my bored, sexually predatory mistress. Directed by Bob Swain, a hot director who recently swept the French Oscars, it also reunites me with Oscar-winning cinematographer David Watkin. With Oscar-winning composer John Barry on board, the filmmaking is state-of-the-art and I love every minute of shooting. Until this movie, I'd been relegated to fairly pedestrian locations, Tulsa, Chicago, St. Augustine, Florida. But Masquerade shoots entirely in the Hamptons, and I fall in love with the low-key, old-money style and lazily debauched nightlife. Charlie Sheen is also in the Hamptons, shooting Wall Street with Oliver Stone and Michael Douglas. It's a good combination for fun, and we make the most of our surroundings. Charlie and I compete to see who can play harder, then show up to work and still kick ass. Verdict? Sheen. By a nose. By the end of the Masquerade shoot, I'm raw and ragged. I've done two films with no break at all. And in both, I was in every scene, working 13-plus-hour days from February to July. Masquerade was a grind for all concerned. On the last day, the writer says to me, "If this fucking movie doesn't work, I am quitting for television." The movie bombed. It was stylish and sexy, maybe too much so, and I still like it very much, but the studio releasing it was being sold and in chaos. I also heard the studio president's wife hated all that sex in the movie. At any rate, my stock took another hit, and it would be my last starring role in a studio movie for many years. Masquerade's writer kept his promise and quit for TV. $1 billion later, I'm happy to have driven Dick Wolf, the creator of the Law & Order franchise, to greener pastures. Chapter 16. With the disappointing performance of these last two movies, the rocket ride suddenly and dramatically slows. The heady and exhilarating G-forces that have buffeted, stimulated, and medicated me for years have quieted, and I look to fill the void. I've thrown myself into politics. In the middle of a 13-state tour, I find myself in Minnesota, about to do an early morning live TV interview for presidential candidate Michael Dukakis. I've been traveling with and for the Massachusetts governor on and off for the last 8 weeks. I've come to love the unique blend of back-breaking campaigning and passionate policy strategy by day and hard-charging nightlife when the day is done. The staff, the advance team, and the traveling press corps can be like a band of marauders in the name of the great American experiment. And while today's road adventures pale in comparison to campaigns of yesteryear, there's still enough of the old guard hacks around to keep the dream alive. We've all come out for a freewheeling convention where Jesse Jackson stole the show with his classic Keep Hope Alive speech and almost spoiler candidacy. There's also tremendous drama surrounding the choice for vice president. Will it be Jackson? Will it be the young buck Al Gore? Will it be an unknown? Unlike today's long-form infomercial conventions where everything is carefully scripted and nothing left to chance, the Atlanta Convention of 1988 was probably the last of its kind where there was some actual chaos and real drama. Downtown one night, I was standing with a group from our delegation at the doors of a nightclub. The doorman was hassling me hard for an ID, which I had left in my jacket back in the car. "Dude, you need proper ID to get in. No one under 21 allowed," said the guy. "Yeah, but you know it's me, right?" "Yeah, and you know I'm over 21. "Sorry, need to see your ID. No exceptions." Jeez, these guys are like the Gestapo, I think, as I schlep back to find my jacket. Finally inside the club, I was approached by two girls who wanted me to join them back at their place. This being most 24-year-old guys' dream scenario, I suggested we reconvene at my suite. Having just received the third degree from the doorman, it never occurs to me that there could possibly be anybody in a club who wasn't of age. As the three of us left, I had no idea that this romp will set in motion events that will ultimately, through a painful, long, and circuitous path, lead me to greater happiness and fulfillment than I could have ever hoped for. And now, sitting for my early morning show interview in Minnesota, I feel the unmistakable saltiness that is the precursor to a live on-air vomit. As they count down to air, I quickly grab a waste paper basket and hide it at my feet. 1, 2. "Good morning, Minneapolis. Today we are talking to Rob Lowe, who's in the Land of the Lakes for Michael Dukakis. Good to see you, Rob. How you doing?" I vomit into my shoes. The food on the road and the grueling after-hours agenda is taking a toll in every way possible. I try for moderation, but my whole life I've only known one gear: full speed ahead. Outrun loneliness, outrun feeling different, and outrun the shock that your dreams coming true don't change your feelings. And like anything with the accelerator stuck, I'm bound to crash. But not quite yet. Although it's probably just a coincidence, after I'm done in Minnesota, Dukakis goes up 3 points statewide. Back on the campaign plane, or Sky Pig, as we called it, I witness something that no man should see. Walking to the front compartment, I see the would-be commander-in-chief having his makeup applied. It's like stumbling into a hot dog factory. You like hot dogs. You know terrible deeds go into making them, but nothing prepares you when you actually see it. A lot of male candidates wear makeup these days, but that doesn't make it right. It really should be a Screen Actors Guild union violation. I like the governor and his family a lot. Like an unfortunately large number of would-be leaders I've known, Mike Dukakis is much more engaging in private. However, his running mate, the legendary Texas Senator Lloyd Benson, turns out to be the real star of the ticket. He and I travel throughout Texas together, and he is mobbed like Mick Jagger wherever he goes. Co-eds lose their minds for the 70-year-old senator. He is brave and romantic, Every time we fly, he reaches out to hold his wife, B.A.'s, hand. They have survived 2 plane crashes together, and still they keep going. One night, at some terrible Motel 6, I'm with the traveling staff watching him debate Dan Quayle. "You're no Jack Kennedy," remains one of my favorite moments in television history. The last presidential debate took place in Pauley Pavilion at UCLA. Sitting with the high command, we all know it's over for our guy after the very first question. Bernard Shaw of CNN opens the debate with, "Governor Dukakis, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?" There are gasps at the question's premise and audacity. Then you can feel the silence filling the room like methane. With the right answer from the candidate, it will explode and everyone knows it. Instead, Dukakis whiffs. Instead of saying, "Well, first of all, I'm offended by your premise," or coming up with a forceful rejoinder to Shaw's provocative bushwhack, he's lethargic and passionless about his wife being raped and murdered. If he'd have said, "As you know, Bernie, I am against the death penalty in all circumstances. That said, if someone were to harm my wife, you'd probably have to use it on me. The guy might have been elected president on the woman's vote alone." Back at the scene of the crime, I address the 14,000 people packed into the historic UCLA arena. It's less than 12 hours away from the polls closing on election eve, and the place is rocking. Even in a campaign that is clearly behind, in the last moments, everyone believes, or at least hopes, that a miracle is at hand. When Dukakis takes the stage, there is a last gasp of optimism. Later, flying down the entirely closed 405 freeway, I get my first taste of the majesty and convenience of life at the threshold of the presidency. The armored limo, the decoy, the war wagon, the staff cars, the follow vans, the press vans, the ambulance, and the phalanx of 30 motorcycle cops providing red light running escorts and protection. The trip from UCLA to LAX should take 20 minutes on a good day. We're on the plane in 12. At 3:45 a.m., we land in an Iowa cornfield. Temporary floodlights illuminate the large crowd who is assembled at this ungodly hour to offer support at this final campaign stop. As the governor speaks for the last time, I see the frost on the corn husks, the vapor rising off the crowd as people listen in the cold. I watch a man raise his small son up onto his shoulders and remember scurrying under a barricade to meet George McGovern so many years ago. Now, I'm grateful to have been able to experience firsthand the emotional, bunker mentality altruism that marks all campaigns. On my left, I see one of Dukakis's inner circle, a large, tough Boston Irish Catholic. He's wiping away tears. We land in Boston before sunrise on election eve. I go to the hotel to make live drive-time radio pitches to get out the vote. By mid-afternoon, I'm with the rest of the campaign at headquarters for the potential victory rally. If anyone is ever wondering what comedian Al Franken did to earn a seat in the Senate, they obviously were not among the 1,000 people watching the results come in at Dukakis' campaign headquarters. Franken, saddled with the single worst job on the planet, works relentlessly, alone on the ballroom stage, to keep the room's fading spirits up. But the crowd can read the writing on the wall, and in the hour and a half that Al vamps, he gets maybe 3 laughs. The Democrats should have given him a Purple Heart. Instead, years later, they brought him to D.C. Michael Dukakis is a profoundly decent, earnest man. He is a personification of the possibilities open to the families of immigrants in our great country, and I admire him very much. Now he is on stage, humbled and gracious in a crushing, decisive loss. I'm standing in the wings, just off stage. After today, it will be time to go back to other pursuits, but nothing will offer the same satisfaction as trying to help change the country, even in a peripheral role. Dukakis is wrapping up his concession. The crowd is on its feet. There hasn't been this much emotion in the campaign for months. Michael waves a final farewell, and the room explodes. He stands there, taking it in. Never an emotional man, it almost looks like there are tears in his eyes. A final wave, and he walks off stage. He stops when he sees me and offers his hand. "Thanks, Rob. I'm sorry I let you down." And I can see that this time, the emotion is real. Months have gone by with no decent movie offers. There are always bad ones, however, like the offer to shoot a sex-filled romantic comedy in Italy, for which I would be paid a fortune and given a Ferrari, or for $500,000 for 10 days' work to do a remake of Heidi of the Hills. The poor performance of my last two movies has put me in a predicament. Too famous to be new, and not enough box office mojo to get the big movies. At least not at the moment. Anyone can run a career when it's going good. It's in the down times, the quiet times, that long-term careers are really made. You need to find a way to stay in the conversation, to be current, and to reinvent yourself. It sounded like a good idea at the time. Would I like to participate in the opening of the 1988 Academy Awards? Without hesitation, I say yes. Mistakenly, I take this as an honor, if not a duty. After all, I'm from Ohio, and if somebody asks you nicely, you do it, particularly if it's the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. I'm invited to the home of the man who will be producing the broadcast, veteran Hollywood showman producer Alan Carr, who has made some very big movies, including one of my all-time favorites, Grease. He also, however, produced a movie version of Sgt. Pepper's without the Beatles and wore a caftan. In retrospect, perhaps I should have known better. The pitch was simple. An elaborate musical number in the style of the famed Copacabana will open the show. A who's who of old-time Hollywood stars will participate, including the biggest box office queen of her era, Snow White. The gag will be that her date stands her up, and I will gallantly come to her rescue. We will then sing a funny, silly duet to the tune of Ike and Tina Turner's Proud Mary. Did I mention that no one was on drugs when we came up with this idea? The great Marvin Hamlisch will be in charge of the music, and other numbers will feature members of Young Hollywood like Patrick Dempsey and Christian Slater tap dancing and swinging around on ropes. Figuring that the plan is to add fun and levity to Oscar night, I sign on as well. Every star can make a bad movie or TV show. If you are lucky, you may get to stay in the business long enough to make several, but very few get to participate in a train wreck in front of a billion people. There are ominous signs from the beginning. During rehearsals, it becomes clear that some of the older Hollywood legends cannot walk unassisted. So the grand procession is scrapped, and they are placed at tables where all they have to do is wave. Snow White is played by a sweet but inexperienced actress with a very high falsetto. The plan is for her to walk the audience and sing to Meryl Streep, Jack Nicholson, et al. However, when the big night arrives and she is faced with the living, breathing, actual stars, her voice jumps up two more octaves to the tonal range that could bust a dog's eardrum. To make matters worse, it will later be discovered that Alan Carr and the Academy have forgotten to get clearance from Disney to use Snow White in the first place. By the time I make my entrance live in front of a billion people, she has that thousand-yard stare common to all performers who are going into the tank. We've all been there. I know the look. I look deep into her eyes, trying to get her to focus on me and steady her nerves. We start our bit together, and it seems to be going well. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I see the great director Barry Levinson in the middle of the audience. He has made Diner. He has made The Natural, and is about to win about 200 Oscars tonight for his new movie, Rain Man. There is nobody hotter or more important on the planet. And I see him very clearly now. His mouth is agape. He looks almost ashen. He turns to his date, his face a mask of shock and disgust. Even in the middle of singing a live duet, I can very clearly read his lips, and he says, "What the fuck is this?" Bravely, I soldier on. I tell myself, who cares what he thinks? He's just an acclaimed artistic genius writer-director about to be anointed King of Hollywood. You can't please everybody. I leave the stage, not having a real sense of how it went over, Levinson's reaction notwithstanding. I make my way to the green room, deserted at this early part of the show, except for an elderly lady with flame-red hair. She's sitting alone in the corner.
"Young man," she says, "I had no idea you were such a good singer. Come sit with me."
I realize it's Lucille Ball. I go and sit with her, and she takes my hand and holds it tightly. She says nothing now, but doesn't let go, and we watch the broadcast play out on a monitor. After a while, she lets go of my hand and asks if I can find her some aspirin.
"My goddamn head is killing me, sweetheart."
I get Lucy her Tylenol, and she kisses me on the cheek. I watch as she goes on to receive her Lifetime Achievement Award to a standing ovation. Within weeks, she will pass away. Every year, people debate what's wrong with the Academy Awards. Why are they always so long, so boring, or just plain terrible? Why are viewers so uninterested? I have my theories, but of these two things, I'm certain. First, don't ever try to take the piss out of the Oscars. The ceremony is not merely escapist fare for the average American. It is of cancer-curing importance, an evening of the highest seriousness, to be revered at all costs. I hadn't realized that. As my teenage son would say, my bad. And second, when Lucille Ball likes what you do, it's hard to give a shit about anybody else. I have just finished remodeling my new house in the Hollywood Hills. It's a quintessential Rat Pack-era bachelor's pad, chosen by me for its view, privacy, and proximity to the Hard Rock Cafe, the latter criteria being most revealing about my current state of mind. I'm becoming increasingly isolated. I rarely see my family. I don't know how to deal with my mother's unraveling marriage or her deteriorating health. I can't escape into my work, as my Oscar disaster hasn't done my career momentum any favors. So, in this period of malaise, I look to boost my spirits where I can. I am now on a feel-good treadmill. Long weekends of adventure and imbibing. Weekly Monday night football get-togethers with the boys, which inevitably lead to Tuesday morning sunrises. Romantically, I am all over the map. I date a group of girls who are beautiful and fun-loving and whom I promise nothing. If they would like more of a commitment from me, they aren't letting me know. That said, I'm also capable of pushing the boundaries of dating technology. I've taken to using MTV as a sort of home shopping network. And it's not beneath me to call up the network to get the contacts on the sexy dancer in the latest Sting video. I also find C-SPAN to be useful in this regard as well. Seeing Oliver North's secretary, Fawn Hall, being sworn in during Iran-Contra, I make a note to track her down. Later, I will take her to Jack Lemmon's Lifetime Achievement Award dinner at the American Film Institute. Future co-star Sally Field will give me a Barry Levinson-esque, "What the fuck?" as I breeze by her table with the striking, blue-eyed, strawberry blonde from the Pentagon. Like Warren Beatty in Shampoo, whose active love life made him feel like he was going to live forever, spinning the many plates of my relationships makes me feel engaged and alive. New infatuations give me a rush that my career can no longer provide. I even live up on Mulholland, where Beatty's character lives at the end of the movie, when he finds himself with nothing to show for his years of skirt chasing. And indeed, as my 25th birthday approaches, I'm feeling pretty empty. Sitting with my family and friends at the back room at Mateo's, I feel like I'm turning 30 or 40. Not one part of me feels like someone in his mid-20s. I've been grinding so long and have traveled so far and seen so much that I've doubled the standard emotional mileage. I am way past warranty. But if one or two drinks makes me feel better, then clearly three or four will really do the trick. And so I take my medicine well. And why not? Last time I checked, it's still the 80s, right? Finally, a great script comes my way. Bad Influence was submitted to producer Steve Tisch by a new young writer as a writing sample. Tisch, showing the kind of wherewithal that would one day make him the only man with both an Oscar and a Super Bowl trophy, says, "Let's make this script." We bring on newcomer Curtis Hanson to direct, and, like Ed Zwick before him, Bad Influence will launch him to the A-list and to films like L.A. Confidential and 8 Mile. Bad Influence is the Faustian story of a meek, regular Joe seduced by a charismatic and possibly dangerous stranger into a life of excitement and sex. Way ahead of its time, David Koepp's screenplay is a marvel of tension, erotic atmosphere, dark humor, and vengeance fulfillment. I originally want to play the more traditional role of the average Joe, but Koepp takes me to lunch and begs me to play the dark and charming sociopath, Alex. Koepp is smart, and the movie's artistic success will also supercharge his career. He will write Carlito's Way for Pacino and a little movie called Jurassic Park as his next project. By the time Coffee arrives, I've switched parts, and James Spader will eventually play the other. Curtis Hanson is also a fantastic writer, and one of his best additions to the script is the use of videotape to bring down my character. Personal video recorders are now the new big thing, and entire movies are being made about this phenomenon. In fact, we cast Spader after seeing a rough cut of Sex, Lies, and Videotape. During the hilarious and harrowing set piece in the middle of Bad Influence, Spader tells my character that his greatest wish is to get out of his impending engagement. So my character Alex secretly videotapes him having sex with a girl he provides and shows it as a special presentation at his fiancée's holiday party. Wish granted. Personal videotaping had rarely been employed as a gotcha device in movies, and Bad Influence used it perfectly. I related to it as well, since I had been videotaping anything in my life that seemed even remotely interesting. Rehearsals were held in a big church just off Highland Avenue in the heart of Hollywood. Just before lunch one day, I'm asked to meet and approve my makeup artist on the film. A production assistant brings her in. I can't believe what I'm seeing. Striding towards me on outrageously long legs is a sexy and big-spirited blonde girl with whom I'd had a blind date years before. It had ended in a sort of confused muddle. Both of us were dealing with breakups, and although we hit it off like gangbusters, neither of us was in any position to make more of a go of it. I remember her telling me that she was a makeup artist and not taking her seriously. She was far too cute, young, and fun. She hardly fit the middle-aged union crew member mold I'd grown used to. "Hi, Cheryl," I say, surprised. "Hey, Rob, good to see you again," she says, and I'm struck once again by her big blue eyes. We make small talk. We've both seen each other around the circuit we travel in and have had many people in common. Eventually, we sit at the long fold-out table in the middle of the old church meeting hall and talk about the job at hand. "What do you want to do with this character?" she asks. "How do you want him to look? Because I have a couple thoughts." Now, at this point in my life, I've done countless movies, many hours of television, and have worked with many makeup artists, some the best in the business. But not once has anyone ever asked me how my character should look. I sit in the chair and they do whatever it is they do, and that's that. And so now I have a thought. This girl sees me differently. And she is different too. Different from all the other girls in my orbit. As we work together, I realize that she is an artist of the face. Later, when she becomes the first choice of every big leading man, including Al Pacino, Alec Baldwin, and Harrison Ford, I will know why. Not only is she great to be around, and let's face it, beautiful, but she knows her shit cold. Go look at Al Pacino in Glengarry Glen Ross, and you'll see what she's capable of. My character in the film is extremely debauched. He has no boundaries, knows no responsibilities or consequences. And I'm digging deep into this world, living this character almost constantly in my own much less malignant version. And I'm rewarded at every turn because the performance in the movie are turning out so well. But when Tom Brokaw leads the evening news with my personal videotape exploits from back in Atlanta, I know I've got a problem. When he's done with me and the second story is Tiananmen Square, the first democratic uprising and potential revolution in the 6,000-year history of China, I know it's a doozy. Sometimes being a trailblazer is overrated. If the Kim Kardashians and the Colin Farrells and the like had let their video oeuvre out into the zeitgeist before mine, mine might have been met with a mere titillated shrug. But in 1989, it wasn't yet common, or even possible, for young couples to sext and Skype each other with nude tapes and photos. Today, there are some who think nothing of taking a naked pic and sending it to their sweetheart. And for some today, having a sex tape is something to be aspired to, and even created for the express purpose of publicity, money, or career advancement. Not so back in the day. As I, and a lot of people, struggled to figure out how I stupidly put myself into this videotape mess, I was approached by no less of an authority on sexual mores than Mr. Hugh Hefner. "You had to do it," he said. "The technology existed." The unrelenting media scrutiny and fallout from the videotape debacle will overshadow Bad Influence completely. Although very well reviewed, the press coverage is mostly about what an idiot I am, and the movie suffers at the box office as a result. The director gets hot from it. Spader gets hot from it. For me, it's just another movie that doesn't perform. That it was released by a tiny independent movie studio didn't help matters, but in the end, even a major studio couldn't possibly have overcome the unfortunate nexus of life imitates art that I'd created. Depressed and under siege, I stay home and self-medicate. I make sure that the fun is always on call to keep me from thinking too hard about my bad decisions or the circumstances of my life. I welcome the support of my family and friends, and after years of work and hundreds of miles traveled for so many liberal democratic candidates and causes, I wait to hear from my many friends in that world. The calls never come. On a more positive note, to help promote the movie, I'm asked to host Saturday Night Live for the first time. Walking into Studio 8H, I feel like I've conquered show business. Forget my current stalled movie momentum and role as public pinata. I'm hosting Saturday fucking Night Live, a show that I've worshipped since its first year on the air back in 1975. Even in my increasingly jaded disillusionment, this opportunity makes me giddy like a kid as I walk the halls of my heroes. My agents and other advisors beg me not to do the show. Historically, it has been the unmasking of many a star as an unfunny stiff, so they don't want me to take any chances. But I'm a gamer, always the guy to take my shots. Sometimes it blows up in my face, like Snow White. Sometimes it can lead to a whole new world. "Do you want me to write a Wayne's World sketch or Sprockets?" asks Mike Myers, one of the few cast members who writes. It's about midnight on Wednesday, and I'm in his tiny cubbyhole office. I choose Sprockets. I love his character of Dieter, the unisexual avant-garde German talk show host with a masturbating monkey. I have no desire to do a Wayne's World, a concept I don't get at all, although I've not seen that many sketches. Mike goes to work, typing underneath a giant poster for the movie Halloween that reads, "The Curse of Michael Myers." This would be the beginning of my part in a number of classic projects made with the magic of Mike Myers and the SNL pedigree. The show will be a huge hit. At one point, I play the then massively popular talk show host Arsenio Hall, complete with giant fake fingers, and the next day, USA Today writes about it. No one has seen me like this, and suddenly I'm on the radar of Lorne Michaels, who has created more legends in comedy than anyone has or ever will. He is the most important and influential tastemaker and gatekeeper in the comedy universe. As the famous SNL closing theme plays that night, I am elated, having gotten away with what all my advisors had thought so dangerous. I hug my castmates, Dana Carvey, Adam Sandler, Chris Rock, David Spade, Phil Hartman, and Mike. Lauren chose them from nowhere, and now they're the 1927 Yankees, Murderers Row. I went to bat with them that night on live television, and in the process discovered that I liked hitting the major league fastball. I'm asked to promote Bad Influence in Australia with a major press tour followed by a vacation of my choosing as a compensation. I can bring one friend. This is going to be a luxurious, exotic trip of a lifetime. I've chosen Fiji as the vacation, and I want to bring the right companion. I run a mental checklist of my guy pals, as well as some of the girls I'm seeing. Do I want to go with a lover or a friend? And then I realize I have one person in my life who's both. We bonded deeply during the shooting of Bad Influence. I was impressed with her artistry and prodigious work ethic. I was happy to be included in the many adventures she concocted for the large group of friends who orbited her. Her advice in my time of chaos was unique and practical, not the airy-fairy navel-gazing or by-the-book, play-it-safe strategy I encountered elsewhere. When she came to see me, she sometimes cooked, a total shocker for a beautiful girl in L.A., and organized my coffee table books. Eventually, we were lovers, but each of us was well known to be a tough catch. Cheryl Burkoff came to Australia with me, and this set in motion a series of events that would unfold rapidly and change my life forever. Australia is a blur. I've brought along a number of pain pills from my old footloose injury, and I gobble them like sweet tarts. Cheryl, who is the most even-keeled girl I've ever known when it comes to partying, spends most of the time making sure that I don't wander off with the more dangerous members of the band in excess. In spite of her attempts to keep the craziness to a dull roar, I leave Down Under with a big tattoo and a series of press appearances, neither of which I have any memory of participating in. By the time we reach Turtle Island, Fiji, I'm out of pills and feeling more present. Cheryl lends me books to read, Richard Bach's Illusions, and new music to listen to, Sinead O'Connor. There are only 12 other couples on this tiny, romantic, tropical paradise where they filmed Blue Lagoon. I haven't had this kind of escape from L.A. or concerns of my life and career in years, if ever. and I've never been with such an easy companion. I begin to feel the lift of the hazy, heavy fog of career, pressure, partying, and self-obsession. In fact, on the first day on the island, I have an epiphany. Cheryl and I are being led along a jungle trail overgrown with palms, ferns, and bamboo as the Fijian tribesman shows us to our quarters. Rounding a giant vine-encrusted tree stump, we come to a small thatched roof bungalow. "This will be your home," says the tribesman, with a beautiful smile making an exit. But something has caught my eye. It is a small wooden sign, placed on the front door and carved by locals. Branded into the wood and painted, it says, "Rob plus Cheryl." I'm flooded with an emotion I cannot name. My eyes blink back tears. I feel lonely and comforted all at once. At the sight of the fairly innocuous sign, I feel an overwhelming sense of occasion, like someone has put my future in writing and I am witness. And irrationally, I know that we will be together, Cheryl plus Rob, and the years unfold before me. Ebbing up from my unconscious and unnamed fantasy, a road is opening up and a world is forming, and it is full of love and marriage and children and joy and fear and wonder. It is a crystalline vision of our potential lives together. Rob plus Cheryl. But I shake it off. This is ridiculous. What is this, a bad movie on the Hallmark Channel? This type of life is the last thing I'm looking for. I order up some kava, the local root that makes you buzzed, and try to push my vision out of my thoughts. But in the days on Turtle Island, watching Cheryl run along the azure water and lying with her head on my leg under the blazing nebula, I can't stop thinking about the little wooden sign on our bungalow door. By the time the helicopter arrives to fly us off the island, I've given in to my growing affection for Cheryl. The time away from my normal life has cleared my head enough to listen to that tiny voice cued by the sign and to acknowledge that even I may be worthy of something more, something real, something with no agenda, that doesn't live in total slavish service to career, public perception, family turmoil, or the pursuit of a good time. I tell Cheryl I love her. "I love you too," she says, and in her remarkable blue eyes, I see the full range of response. We climb into the waiting chopper, its rotors blasting sand into the lagoon. We lift off, hover for a moment, then head into the rising sun. We are moving quickly. Cheryl and I have a long journey ahead. Chapter 17. It takes less than 24 hours back in L.A. for me to destroy this relationship that, away from the chaos of my life, I had wanted so much. Away from the pressures and temptations of my everyday existence, I was a different person. Someone who wanted to slow down, someone who wanted some consistency and commitment. And finally, I'd found the right person, Cheryl, with whom I thought I could attempt to fashion this new life. But back in my bachelor pad in the Hollywood Hills, this vision is immediately fogged by fear and force of habit. I am frozen and unable to see my way off the merry-go-round. As usual, a night out with the boys leads to tequila and a party. Properly anesthetized for a night amongst the throngs, I look for the cutest girl I can find. Cheryl, ever the career girl, is asleep at home, leaving in the early morning for yet another movie on location. I'm drunk and back at my place with a total stranger. At about midnight, Cheryl calls to check in on me. I was supposed to have called her earlier, and she hears a girl's laugh in the background. I try to play it off, but she knows what's going on. "This isn't a good idea," she says. "What do you mean?" "You and I. We should just be friends." No, I'm sorry. I want to be with you. Ron, stop. Listen to me. We've always been friends above all else. Let's not ruin that. You should go and do what you need to do and be with who you want. But I can't be your girlfriend." She's not angry. I can't even tell if she's sad. It is actually the worst possible scenario because she just seems done. "Goodbye, Rob. Let's talk when I get back from location." She hangs up. I hold the phone in my hand. I stare out at the big plate glass window and see the girl, illuminated by the lights of the cityscape. It is backlit and it's dark, but it looks like she's naked, swaying gently to the sounds of Robbie Robertson coming over the outdoor speakers. She is beautiful, for sure, and she beckons me with a mischievous smile and a bottle of Cuervo. How do you feel? She yells, and I hear it, muffled through the glass window. I feel nothing, I answer, even though I know she can't hear me. Rob, Rob, pick up, it's your mother. It's a few hours later, and I'm standing over my answering machine with its 73 unanswered messages. Rob, please, are you there? Begs my mother, clearly in a panic. But I am too fucked up to pick up the phone. There is no way that I can face her in my condition. Your grandfather is in the hospital. He's had a massive heart attack. I listen to my mom as she describes his critical condition and asks for my help. Still, I do nothing. I stare at the answering machine, frozen, until my mom hangs up. As the shame and guilt begin to penetrate my altered state, I begin to hatch a plan of attack. I need to chug this last bit of tequila so I can get to sleep, so I can wake up ASAP and deal with this. This insane logic holds right up until I catch a glance of myself in the bathroom mirror. Then, very slowly, I turn and face myself full on. I'm so hammered that I can barely stand. The girl I love has just left me because I can't keep my word and I have no integrity. My grandfather is dying. My mother is in crisis, desperate for help and comfort, and I have cowered and hid in shameful avoidance. I have arrived at the bottom. Since I was a boy, I've been running. Running to make my mark. Running to avoid reality. Running to avoid pain. And now, a moment of clarity. I can run no longer. I go into my bedroom, past the sleeping girl, and find my wallet. In it is a business card that I've carried for over a year. I find it and pull it out. It's from a drug and alcohol counselor named Betty Wyman. I take her card, head back to my office, and sit next to the phone. I hear the terrible chirping of the early morning birds. I watch the cityscape gray on the horizon as the sun begins to rise. A new day is beginning. I make the call. It's May 10th, 1990. There are many kinds of rehabs. You can pretty much get any setup that suits you. You've got your shaved head, cuckoo's nest, hardcore lockdowns. You've got your latte sipping, horseback riding, yoga-centric country clubs. You've got your remote, Spartan locations. You've got them smack dab in the middle of L.A., convenient for visits from managers, agents, publicists, and dealers. I'm on a plane headed to Arizona for a middle-of-the-road version. Betty Wyman, in her wisdom, got me the hell out of L.A. to a serious rehab, but well short of a lockdown. Less than 48 hours have passed since I called her, but Betty moved quickly when I said, "Help me. I want to stop. I'll do whatever you tell me to do." Now I sit, shaking with anxiety, next to her associate, Bob, who is escorting me to the monkey farm. Bob is a former Hell's Angel. He's tattooed from head to toe and with a beard that makes him look like Charles Manson, but a voice that sounds like Kermit the Frog. "Let me tell you my story," says Bob, attempting to comfort my now crushing anxiety and to bond us together. "I first remember feeling different and scared and anxious when I was a little boy and my mom invited the mailman into our apartment. We found out later, but didn't know then, that she was a paranoid schizophrenic," he says in his sweet, Kermit-like, sing-song voice. "Anyway, she stabbed the mailman to death, then cut his body up with a butcher knife. She lay me down in our bathtub and placed his severed limbs on top of me. She told me that God would be angry, but this would protect me." Bob takes a sip from his 17th cup of coffee and continues. "Anyway, that was hard for me. And growing up, after Mom was committed, I got into heroin and selling it. I went to prison, but when I got out, I got sober, and I have been now for 17 years. I try to conjure up an appropriate response to this story, but my instincts tell me that since there's no way to top it, I should just take it in." Bob smiles. "Don't you worry about a thing. You're right where you should be. Scared. Freaked out and shattered. Ain't nobody ever gotten sober who wasn't." The rehab, and I won't name it to protect anonymity, and any of the names that I use in this chapter have been changed, sits low in the foothills of glowing Red Rock Mountains. There's nothing but saguaro cactus for miles. If I decide to flee, it will be a long walk to civilization. But I won't flee. Bob will check me in, say goodbye, and I will begin one of the most thrilling, liberating, and exciting 4 weeks of my life. Scary, yes, and filled with unspeakable emotional discomfort. But for me, it's an unquantifiable relief that I am being shown a different way to live. I'm so tired of the lying, of my inability to keep my word, the bullshit relationships, the hangovers, the cover-ups, and the helplessness to stop doing the things I truly wanted to stop doing. I had long ago become a creation that was an amalgam of self-crafted persona built to succeed, public image made to be consumed, piled on top of a precarious shell of a little boy wanting to be loved. Finally, the whole thing had caved in around me, and now I am thrilled. Now, just maybe, I can find out who I really am. My roommate is a loud, snoring, middle-aged cross-dresser. He looks just like the main character from King of the Hill. I melt hot wax and put it into my ears to sleep at night. I'm going to be here for 30 days, and I'm not going to make it without any sleep. Unlike some rehabs of today, there were very strict ground rules. Whereas now, a rehabbing starlet can check in and still swan around the Malibu Country Mart to get a Frappuccino and a copy of Us Weekly to take to her mani-pedi before her photo shoot, we have no reading materials, TV, privileges to leave, or even caffeine. It's for serious folks only, the Harvard of treatment centers. I am under the care of a hip young counselor named Mike. And being hip is a big plus for me because my greatest fear is that being sober means being boring. And to me, that would be worse than cirrhosis of the liver. I am also worried about people finding out that I am in rehab. When I share this with Mike, he says, "You don't think people know you party too much? You should hope they hear you're getting help." But it proves to be a moot point by, as the third day, I have to hide in the pool to escape the helicopters from the National Enquirer. They tell me that there's a wonderful program that's helped millions get sober called Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't know. My level of anonymity consisted of being on the Enquirer cover, dressed in my underwear, they used a movie still, with a headline about rehab for sex addiction, which, in hindsight, is an improvement from my last national media exposure. At least this time I had underwear. But it pisses me off because the sex addicts in the center have so much more interesting stories and treatments than my group of drinkers did. But my relationship with women, and every other relationship in my life, are a big part of the puzzle that was worked on each day in therapy. I dig into issues with my mother, her illness, my father and abandonment, and my relationship with being famous. I'm surprised by what I learn about myself. I had assumed that since I love the scene, that I also love crowds and people and small talk and the like. Free of alcohol, I learned that while I do love people, I hate small talk, am bored by idle banter, and wildly uncomfortable in big rooms with people I don't know. I want a real connection, not a surface one. And in its absence, I will medicate my discomfort or boredom. Like being in Fiji, being in treatment lets my real self emerge. But first, it will have to gradually strangle the good-looking, successful, charming, poster boy pod person that stunted its growth so many years ago. There is a school of thought that believes your emotional maturity is frozen at the exact age you become famous. My experience tells me that this is more true than not, and I got famous as a teenager. So if I want to be a fully functioning, sober adult, I'd better get busy. Cheryl is the only person other than my family I let visit me. And showing her true colors, she works from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. in Seattle, drives an hour and a half, catches a plane, flies 3.5 hours to see me for the 1 hour allotted on Thursdays, makes the return trip, and is back at work the next day. I am never happier to see anyone than when I see her mane of blonde hair in the window of the arriving cab. We hold hands in the day room, anything else was grounds for expulsion, and walk along the trails through the enormous cactus. "I'm proud of you. I love you," she says, "and I feel better already." Fridays are graduation days. I'm standing in the large circle we formed to surround those who are leaving this cocoon to try their hand at a new life in the real world. Some won't make it 90 days. Most won't make it beyond a few years. And for some, this will not be their first time in treatment. Some come back again and again, more broken and yet more brave each time. It's painful to watch. I don't want to do this again. Not ever. I know two things. I take direction for a living, and I'm competitive. This gives me great advantage. If they tell me to stand on my head to be sober, I will do it. And I won't let anyone get the better of me while I try. So, as I gather my days, free of alcohol or any mind-altering substance, I know that I won't give up my string of days, my time, for anyone or anything. I can be so extraordinarily self-centered. Now I will try to use it for a greater good. I would kill for a cup of coffee. I would drown puppies for a Big Mac. I would really also very much like to get laid. Forget not drinking for 30 days. How about not having sex? I mean, I hadn't gone 30 hours previously. And what would that be like, stone cold sober, without even a glass of wine to loosen me up? Would I really never drink again? No toast on New Year's? No celebratory sip at my wedding, if I ever had one? No beer with the boys, if I ever had a boy? Not even a sip? Not ever? After days and days of therapy, discussion groups, watching some very shattered people pull themselves together, tugging at the frayed strands of their lost lives, it's time to leave. I've been to sober school, and as always, was the first to sit in the front row, ready to learn. And I loved every inspiring, painful minute. But now, as I stand in the goodbye circle, I'm filled with shaky apprehension. In 3 hours, I will be back in L.A., in the bachelor pad, right back in the middle of a life designed by a man I hope I no longer am. But Cheryl will be with me. Over the 4 weeks of treatment, I earned her trust and another chance for us to be together. I hug my counselor, Mike, goodbye. He looks me hard in the eye. Remember, you can be one of those celebrities who goes in and out of rehab, or you can just stay sober. It is completely up to you. Cheryl and I slide into the cab for the ride to the airport and back to our lives. We pull onto the beautiful, winding desert road, the scenery extraordinary on all sides. I try to look ahead to see where the road is leading, but I can't. The bomb shelter is about the size of a giant dining room table. The Israelis packed into it speak no English, and I can barely see them, as the pillbox's only illumination is a dull overhead light bulb. The shelter sits 2 stories below a community park in a suburb about 25 minutes outside Tel Aviv. I'm on location, making a new movie, but I need an AA meeting, and this is the only one I can find. I have no idea what these guys are talking about, as my Hebrew is limited to say the least, but being with people, however different, who have the same disease and are all filled with a newfound grace is exactly what I need. After all, I'm only 60 days sober. The movie I'm making is called The Finest Hour. The end product won't be mine. In the early, heady, euphoric, I don't give a fuck, my life's been saved days of my early recovery, I'm happy to let the chips fall where they may. I wanted to play this character, a tough Navy SEAL, and experience that world. I trained with the SEALs at BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition, in Coronado. In fact, I broke a rib on the hellish obstacle course. I spent hours training underwater, learning to scuba dive, being thrown into the ocean with my hands and feet bound, trying to stay afloat, practicing ring pickups, in which a passing Zodiac yanks you out of the water as you swim to the surface. I became a marksman with my MP5 automatic and learned to hold my breath for 2 minutes and 25 seconds while swimming underwater. I did daily open ocean swims in full fatigues, boots, and carrying a backpack. I had the time of my life. But when Cheryl and I landed in Israel to shoot it, it all went to hell. The film's producer was the notorious and infamous Menachem Golan, known for making the occasional rare gem among a lifelong oeuvre of cheap schlock. Golan had recently been on a roll with his company, Canon Films. He would now overpay to attract legitimate talent. Dustin Hoffman was doing a movie for Canon until Golan took out an ad welcoming him to the Canon family before the deal was done, at which point Dusty bailed, and then make the films for as little money as possible. Hence, this movie about the American military was being shot in Israel. We butted heads on day one. I had absorbed the pride and professionalism of the heroes that I had trained with amongst the SEALs, and I wasn't going to let cost or expediency keep me from portraying them in the correct light. So, when they didn't want to provide the authentic and probably expensive weapons that the real SEALs carried, I balked. I finally had to purchase and ship the MP5s, rather than use the Israeli-made Galils, which would have made me a laughingstock amongst the teams. In spite of the movie having tons of action, as one would reasonably expect from a movie about underwater commandos, Mr. Golan did not want to pay for a stunt coordinator or stuntmen. Instead, some of the cast who had been SEALs worked with former Israeli commandos to set up and execute the stunts. Swelled with new sober exuberance, as well as high from the level of testosterone from my intensive training, I thought, no problem. I'll just do my own stunts. It would almost cost me my life. After my AA meeting in the bunker, Cheryl is applying my camo makeup, which now, after weeks of wearing it, has made my skin painfully raw. Be careful out there, she says, as we are jostled by the heaving PT boat that serves as our shooting location. We are miles off the coast of a horrible, bustling port on the Mediterranean Sea, somewhere near the town of Haifa, to shoot the climax of the movie. I will be hanging off the back of a burning, speeding patrol boat, being dragged face down in the boat's wake, struggling to free my foot, which is tangled in a rope. As I struggle not to drown, I will reach up, hack myself free with my K-bar, or knife, and fall into the boat's massive wake at full speed, and be shot out through the foamy turbulence to safety. One of the former SEALs does a test run, and all goes according to plan, so I take my place as the cameras roll. I notice that Cheryl has left her perch on the front deck. She doesn't want to watch. I'm wearing a cable under my fatigues that attaches me to the racing, lurching boat. After I'm dragged for a few seconds, I will cut the rope. The cable will release, throwing me into the wake. Of course, the Canon budget prevents the use of non-toxic bee smoke, so rubber tires are burned instead, as smoke blankets the boat. Choking, I lower myself backwards and then go headfirst into the wake. I'm submerged to the waist and buffeted so hard that the buttons on my top are immediately ripped off. I never hear them yell action. I struggle to breathe and not dislocate an arm as I'm dragged at full speed. When the director has enough footage, he releases the cable. With a snap, I am violently sucked into the wake, tumbling head over heels again and again like being in a washing machine. Unlike the test run, I am not being spit out the back. In fact, I'm now drowning for real. I hear an awful thudding noise as I continue to tumble out of control. I realize it's the sound of my head hitting the hull of the boat. And now I can also begin to feel the sensation of being sucked under towards its massive propellers. When I hear a muffled, high-pitched whir, I know I'm going in. I have a last thought. Maybe all this gear I'm wearing will give me some sort of protection from the blades. And then I'm hit. The force almost knocks me out with its violence. Everything goes black. When the cobwebs clear, I'm choking on seawater, floating behind the patrol boat, finally free of its prop wash. Seeing that I was headed into the propeller, one of the former SEALs had jumped into the wash, bear-hugging me in protection as we headed towards the blades. Miraculously, his added weight was enough to suck me out of the vortex. After I'm hauled back onto the boat, Cheryl goes nuclear. You're done shooting today. Fuck these assholes and their incompetence. We're going home. The director wants no part of Cheryl and calls a wrap. I thank the SEAL for saving my life. A few days later, I try to maintain the spirit of gallantry on the set when the producers attempt to force a young actress to take her top off during a scene. It's totally uncalled for, completely gratuitous, and the girl is scared that if she doesn't show her tits, she'll be fired. I take her aside. Put your top on and keep it on. If anyone makes a peep, you send them to me and tell them I say nobody takes their clothes off in this movie. Soon, Menachem Golan is storming around the set, but the scene is cut. Menachem, is everything okay? I ask.
No. Everything is terrible. I come to see nipple. I see nothing.
It's no surprise to me when the underfunded The Finest Hour bombs, but I don't care. After spending my entire life single-mindedly drilling down for success as an actor, I'm less and less interested in the Hollywood program. With a new perspective from sobriety and a new meaningful relationship, it's harder and harder to care about my latest review or box office. I want what I've never had, a normal life. And so, after spending the 80s working on a career, I will spend the 90s working on a life. Cheryl won't move in with me. She has a house of her own, works hard to pay for it, and values her independence. So we divide time between our places. I'm coming up on a year sober, after daily recovery meetings and once-a-week men's group therapy sessions, which I love. I've never been happier. And when someone points out that Cheryl is somebody you want in your foxhole. She'd jump in front of a bus for you. The words hit a nerve. And so, on June 20th, 1991, I asked her to marry me. Parked up on Mulholland Drive before a magnificent Los Angeles skyline, Cheryl says yes. I knew my fiancé was a go-getter, but nothing prepares me for what happens next. Like most guys, the mere act of proposing was a Herculean feat that I thought would keep me in my gal's good graces for months, maybe even years to come. But no. Within 20 minutes of arriving home from Mulholland, Cheryl has gotten me to name a date, and the date is only a month away. Her logic is this. If you're engaged, then it's just a sham if you don't mean it, and if you mean it, you should have no issue with setting a date. Can't argue that. And the quick turnaround on the wedding day? Rob, if we wait, every Tom, Dick, and Harry will come out of the woodwork to talk us out of it. The naysayers, the fearmongers, the press will weigh in, you name it, and everybody will want their 2 cents worth. This is about us, no one else. And what's the worst thing that can happen? If it doesn't work out, I'll always be your friend. And so we make a secret plan. We will be married in 4 weeks on July 22nd in an intimate and under-the-radar affair. My mother goes ape. She has all kinds of ideas in her head about Cheryl's agenda, as do a number of my friends. 20 years of marriage and 2 almost grown sons later, I'm sad to say that these folks' concerns had more to do with their own agendas than mine or Cheryl's well-being. Although Mom will eventually calm down, Cheryl and I remove the "does anyone object to this union" portion of the vows just in case of a mutiny. We tell the 30 guests that they are going to a wedding-themed charity lunch, so they will dress appropriately, won't be thrown by the decor, and will have no idea what's happening until we lock the doors. Friends of ours have provided their beautiful home in Hancock Park, overlooking the historic golf course. Even the catering staff thinks it's a charity lunch. As a result, the press never got to sell one issue off our backs. I always roll my eyes when celebrities wail about their privacy being invaded by the media. If you're willing to make certain choices and live in a particular way, you can live a mostly normal life. But many stars would go insane without all the attention, so they won't do what needs to be done to stay out of the spotlight. On the big day, I'm fixing my tie late for the ceremony when the phone rings. It's Lauren Michaels. "Rob, I need you to come to dinner tonight with the studio to talk about Wayne's World," he says. Both he and Mike Myers had not forgotten my good show for them, and they want a real movie actor in what would be both Mike and Dana Carvey's first film. "Geez, Lauren, I can't make it," I say. "Rob, it's a very important dinner." "Lauren, I'm walking out the door to get married. Then I guess even dessert is out of the question." I rush to Hancock Park. The wedding goes without a hitch. Cheryl and I say our vows in front of our semi-stunned friends and family, including Steve Tisch, Gary Marshall, and Emilio. Cheryl is breathtaking in her gown, and I feel like together we will blaze a trail of love, hope, and possibility. I'm not sure that everybody else is down with this program, but that's okay with me. Hollywood has always had its share of bullshit marriages, and, like my sobriety, only time will tell if ours will last. But as we have our first dance to John Barry's gorgeous Out of Africa theme, I'm hoping that Cheryl and I can beat the odds. Chapter 18. Never look a grizzly bear in the face, don't stare at the sun, and never, ever look Dana Carvey in the eyes during a comedy sketch. There are a number of world-class comedy killers in Hollywood, but Carvey is without question the top assassin. Even during his tenure at SNL, when he was surrounded by what was probably the show's best cast ever, his superiority was acknowledged with a nickname, The Lady. Dana will do anything and everything to make you laugh. Like they say about the Terminator, "You can't stop him. It's all he does." Now I'm doing a scene from Wayne's World on stage 14 at Paramount. I try to manipulate Garth, played by Dana, into turning on Wayne as he works in the basement on a mechanical hand. With each take, Dana tries to get me to laugh. His eyes are demented. Now, I'm fairly well known for my ability to stand in the fire and not break character, but Carvey is rising to the challenge. My palms stream rivulets of sweat. My heart is pounding, but I'm not letting this maniac in a blonde wig take me down. I'm a rock. By take 15, Carvey has worked his way through ad-libs, faces, and baby noises. Now, from nowhere, he produces a cartoon-like mallet and smashes the robot hand to bits. It's hilarious. My chest heaves, like when you want to weep but bite your tongue not to. And I stare at him, still stone-faced. It feels like an eternity before the director yells cut. Then I die laughing. Carvey winks. Cheryl and I cut short our Cabo San Lucas honeymoon when my Wayne's World deal closed. Shooting was to begin right away. Now, over a year into sobriety, I've gone through tremendous changes. The two most marked have brought me to this movie. I've learned to only concern myself with my end of any transaction. I do the best job I can, and then let the results be what they will. I am out of the people-pleasing business. So I don't handicap the potential of a movie about two guys in bad wigs who've never acted, based on a 3-minute comedy sketch directed by a punk rocker who's never made a hit film. It feels right somehow, and so I say yes, and that's that. But I've also learned to confront people when I'm being taken advantage of, to enforce boundaries, when in the past I either had none or let people encroach upon them while I stuck my head in the sand. This will prove great for growth and maturity, and not so great in show business, which thrives on actors being distracted, checked out, and fearful. So, when Paramount wants to pay me less than half my fee that I've worked over a decade to establish, I say no, and head to Cabo with my wife. But just before we walk out the door, Cheryl, who has a fantastic business mind, says, "Tell them you'll take half your fee, up front, but half as a back-end payment, like the producers." It's a brilliant compromise, and Paramount says yes. This will be the only back-end deal profit I will ever receive in my 30-plus year career. Wayne's World also brings me closer to a group of people who will be friends, confidants, mentors, and collaborators for the next decade. Lorne Michaels, Mike Myers, and their manager, the legend Bernie Brillstein, whom I sign with as well. "I remember the first time I saw you, Bernie," I tell him at our first meeting. "I was 14 years old, and you were with John Belushi at The Tonight Show."
"I remember the first time I saw you, kid. You were with Fawn Hall at Jack Lemmon's AFI Award, and I thought, that kid is so cool. What balls," said Bernie,
who will not only help me navigate the next 15 years of my career, but will become a second father as well. Wayne's World is a hit. Mike Myers' vision is universally accepted into the rare category of smash comedy and timeless classic. Even today, it brings me a new crop of fans every year. Thanks, Lorne. Thanks, Mike. One of my great thrills was having a big movie in the theaters simultaneous with my Broadway debut. Living with Cheryl in a penthouse at the Regency Hotel, being driven past the lines for Wayne's World to the stage door for A Little Hotel on the Side at the Belasco Theater, I was living the actor's ultimate dream. I didn't become an actor to get famous. I didn't become an actor to get rich. I was too young and unsophisticated to really understand that these things were even really an option. I just wanted to do what I loved. And now I was doing it at the highest levels in the two areas I most valued. I also felt a sense of peace and satisfaction from my marriage and the early steps in recovery. I went to meetings with other alcoholics daily, and so each day my old ways and perspectives changed. I took fewer chances in my personal life and more in my work. I found fulfillment in new areas. I was no longer the it guy of the 80s or the sole star of studio movies, but I didn't care. I left that for others who kept track of such things and who never knew that that particular club had been toxic for me anyway. I worked with collaborators who challenged me and who weren't interested in Rob Lowe but wanted the right actor for the right role, like Sir Richard Eyre of the National Theater and Dame Maggie Smith.